Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. The Ralph Nader Hour with Ralph Nader came to you on recording over a listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Think about becoming a WBAI buddy. You can go to the website, give2wbai.org. Sign up, and each month a certain amount is taken out of your account, and that will be a cushion that BAI can rely on a monthly basis and plan accordingly. So go to our website, give2wbai.org. Coming up is Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 7 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
On October 24th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Richard Tucker Park on 66th Street and Broadway, Crossways Theater presents a stop anti-Asian hate play titled COVID Crime. Speakers Shirley Eng from Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund and Jackie Wang from Welcome to Chinatown. Free. Peace cranes will be distributed.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This week we will hear part two of my 1976 interview with Frank Herbert along with Margot Adler. But first, a review of the third screen version of Dune by Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. When the opening title of Denis Villeneuve's new version of Dune come up on screen, and if you haven't seen it already, I'm going to break with my personal prohibition against being a buyer's guide and say, go, see it. In theaters, ideally, if you're feeling comfortable with it, or on HBO Max on the biggest screen you can wrangle, if that's the way you gotta do it. But when those opening titles come up, you'll notice that a teeny tiny apologetic part one has snuck in under the main title. That was nowhere in any of the marketing materials, and I can understand why Warner Brothers did that, but it will cause groans of agony from those now realizing that they're not going to be getting the full novel in this one movie. But hey, it's better than what Bakshi did with Lord of the Rings. But I would suggest to you that one of the reasons why this latest attempt at Dune is such a triumph is because Villeneuve wisely decided to invest his 2.5 hours into telling only half the story. Villeneuve is an interesting director overall. He has the cool precision of a Kubrick, but there's a humanistic passion to him that threads through his best work. His films can be formalistically daring, yet the soul remains. As has been noted elsewhere, everywhere actually, Dune is stunningly beautiful, a masterpiece of cross-pollination between location shooting, production design, cinematography by relative newcomer Greg Fraser, and mostly great special effects. The Atreides' home planet of Caladan has a rough, natural lushness, while the desert world of Arrakis, the dune of the title, is captured in stark, sometimes downright surreal relief. But beyond stunning production, what gives this dune its power is Villeneuve's deliberate, thoughtful approach to the story. By giving the far future tale of a young prince rising to the status of planetary messiah room to breathe, the director brings you fully into the film, gives you the space to appreciate the scope of the story and the nuances of the drama. It's not sheer perfection. Timothée Chalamet, as soon-to-be messiah Paul Atreides, isn't the strongest of actors, although he does comport with my mind's eye image of the prince. And even though it's only half the story, the film does run several beats too long, although I'd be hard-pressed to determine which beats should have been excised. Even with that, I don't hesitate to say that Dune Part 1 is a masterpiece worthy of joining the pantheon of great science fiction films. Let's hope Warner Brothers sees fit to let Villeneuve finish his epic. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons. Thank you, Dan. If you want to hear more of Dan, and for that matter, my assessment of Dune Part 1, join Dan and I, and with any luck another critic and pundit, this Sunday, October 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, for a live video chat simulcast on YouTube and Facebook. For YouTube, just go to youtube.com/C/JimFreund, that's F-R-E-U-N-D, or go to Facebook and look in the Hour of the Wolf group. Both venues will have the interview archived, but of course, you can only chat with us when we are live. Last week, we heard a tad more than half of my interview with Frank Herbert from 1976, which was part of his book tour for Children of Dune, the final book in the series. Never mind that Frank wrote at least three more, and his son Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson have written at least another 7 or 8 novels, and I'm sure there are more to come. But at the time, Frank claimed that it was a trilogy and it was done. There's little question that politics notwithstanding, Dune is a masterpiece of science fiction. I would say that Dune Messiah swung the opposite direction, but that Children of Dune was quite good, and perhaps should have ended the series there. But clearly, the market wants more. So this interview was conducted before the ink had dried on any contract for a movie version. Happily, Margot Adler, who was no longer at WBAI full-time, was able to come by and join me, and it makes all the difference in the interview, bearing in mind Margot's understanding of pagan or neo-pagan religion and the Bene Gesserit, and Margot's deep understanding of world politics. When the novel of Dune was first serialized and then came out as a novel, that made up three works that changed big publishing's view of speculative fiction. The other two books were Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. All three were adopted by the left-leaning mid-60s college crowd. But Herbert wasn't necessarily that far left himself. The novel contains easily recognizable homophobia and a worldview of American and Arab relations that made a major element clear. A white man becomes the savior for third world people who just happen to control the most valuable substance the first world wants. Not oil, but spice. Herbert talks frankly about those politics, thanks to Margot. He was complicated. He was anti-Vietnam, but pro-Nixon. So let's get back into that Wayback Machine some 54 years ago and listen to part two of that discussion. Part one is, of course, in the WBAI archives.
I assume that people have already said, take the Dune trilogy and make it a tetralogy. Might that happen?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
When you wrote Dune, did you have the entire trilogy set out?
Oh, yes. Before I wrote the first book, I knew where the third one was going.
Mm-hmm. And
I had them all plotted. You see?
Fully.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see any... So you don't see any room for a fourth book or take it beyond where this ends?
No. This does what I set out to do.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to read it. The only reason I ask is because I saw in one of the clippings that Putnam sent me some comment on the order of, well, the book ends, I understand, similar to Dune in that something will happen. You know something is going to happen at the end.
Well, I take the reader into my confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I always have. I believe that that writing is a game you play between your own imagination and the reader's imagination, and you have to respect the reader's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You have to enlist it to its fullest capabilities, and you have to allow the reader's imagination to write as many variations on the theme in his head as he wants to write,
mm-hmm.
as he feels capable of writing or is interested in writing. All of these things apply. And so I write to spin the reader out of the story, but with lots of it fish-hooked into his mind, trailing in his mind, so that he can play games with it even further. And so I've done that, obviously, in Dune, and I do it again in Children of Dune. But I send them back into the beginning of the story in a cyclic fashion, you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Are you not afraid, though, that... 100 years from now, somebody's going to take a look at this classic book and say, needs a sequel. And some stumble bum is going to attempt it and publish it.
Let him. Why should I be worried about that? If it's any good, marvelous. If it's not any good, I doubt if it'll succeed.
Mm. Margot Adler, sitting quietly in the room, asks a question which we already touched on, but I would like to get back to because there are just so many things to explore. When we were, quote, playing that cut of music or turned off the mic for a minute, we were saying there are so many different things you can explore, so many directions to go within SF that there's just no way that... you can know exactly where you're going to be
no
leading.
No two performances are going to be identical as it is with jazz.
Yeah, and you can barely skim the surface. So pardon me if I go back to what was before.
You want absolution or you just want to be temporarily forgiven?
Absolution. I couldn't bear people. Okay, well, Getting back to the concept of the Bene Gesserit, are you aware? Well, why don't you ask this yourself? Come over here.
I was just wondering if you are aware that there's a group that is starting or has been planning to start in the last 3 years a school of American shamanism under the name of the Bene Gesserit School.
Think of it as Bene Gesserit, as female Jesuits.
Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, they won't like that. The school is definitely pagan.
Well, the Jesuits have a lot of pagan roots, you know. They wouldn't admit that, but, well, some of them would. I've met a couple of Jesuits who would.
Mm-hmm.
But the, that's fine. Let them have their games, and that's exactly what I was talking about just now. You leave those openings in what you do, because you have confidence in the imagination of your fellow humans. You don't talk down to them, you don't talk up to them, you talk straight across to them. You say, hey, this is a marvelous game to play, we will play it anyway, why don't we play it this way for a while?
What would happen, I mean, let's conceive of this, we were before discussing religion as law and law as religion. What would happen if this group becomes quite popular, increasingly so, and in fact starts a bit of a movement within the U.S.? You're going to be sitting there sort of the creator of the creator, so to speak.
Well, I hope that they don't get so lost in their own mythology that they lose all self-consciousness, that they can or will still be able to laugh at themselves.
Mm.
They will.
Yeah.
Yeah, it appears that way. I'm thinking in terms also of this person out in the Midwest by the name of Tim Zell, who many years ago started the Church of All Worlds, which was somewhat based on religion, if you want to call it that, in a strange land.
Yeah, Heinlein would, well, Bob likes to keep at least 100 miles between himself and fans, and I'm sure that he would not enjoy that at all. And my own feeling about cultists is that I hope they're not too fanatical. I hope that they are capable of laughing at themselves and some of their antics,
mm-hmm.
that they have elbow room inside the myth they are building.
Mm-hmm. Do you see positive aspects to cultism?
Oh, I think we ought to take a hand in myth construction. Myth construction happens to us so much that I think we ought to turn around and start engineering our myths and exploring the whole myth-making function of a society. And if we don't like certain myths, make others. We tend to fall into traps, into hero traps in our society. For God's sakes, look at what happened with the Kennedy clan. They fitted themselves right into a pre-organized, a pre-embedded myth, which was all the myth system, which was already in our society. Who called them Camelot? You see, who brought that out? It was a natural thing to happen. They had the young hero, the seeking the Holy Grail, who could do no evil. They had the Virgin Queen, who marries the young hero. They had the wise old man. They had the fool. I hope Pierre Salinger doesn't mind my calling him the fool. Well, in the tarot sense, you know, this is not a foolish thing.
Yeah.
The fool in tarot was the one who asked the improbable question.
Yes.
They had the magician, the man who does the impossible, who does the unexpected, Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
They had all of the characters that you find in classical mythology, and they had such perfect fits in their Camelot that you wondered if it just happened or if they did it.
I guess the last card in laying out those in that particular tarot plan would have been the Tower.
In fact, it is the world.
It is the world, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider, and I have a very strong suspicion that you do you consider science fiction, in fact, myth-making, myth-constructing?
A lot of science fiction is myth-making. I've written several books to explore different myth-making lines in our society. I wrote Destination Void, for example, to deal with that element of fandom, which believes that the only thing wrong with the universe is that we haven't invented the right machine yet. The machine becomes their god. It already is.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to examine these assumptions, these unexamined assumptions in our society. Take a good, long, cold look at them.
Mm-hmm.
We have right now upcoming a political campaign in which it is highly likely that Jimmy Carter will be elected president. Carter is setting himself up and being set up, because it doesn't happen all from within. The society tends to reflect back on the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Is setting himself up to fit a certain mythological pattern, which is already there in the unconscious of our society. He has set a difficult role for himself, to be both the young hero and the wise old man simultaneously. I think he's capable of it. I just hope that he, personally, does not get lost in his own mythology, because we tend to kill our heroes in this society,
mm-hmm.
in this Western society. And I think that that's a kind of an expelling a foreign body part of it in the society, that the society as a whole gets violent.
Mm-hmm.
I deplore it, but I tell you, it does happen, and there's a long history of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are probably a limited number of myths that are simply destined to recycle themselves constantly?
Well, I think that that has been the history of myth-making in our society, because if you will find counterparts to Western mythology in Oriental mythology,
mm-hmm.
you find almost perfect fits. What I'm saying is that we ought to explore this myth-making facility in human beings as a consciousness exercise, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Would you correlate the Dune trilogy to any past myth?
Any past myth?
One that is known, say, to classics majors or...
Well, I drew on Greek mythology mm-hmm. for it, and Atreides, or the family of Atreus, you know, and a lot of people have spotted this. A lot of classical scholars have spotted it. And I deliberately did this.
I noted in Children of Dune that one of the people speaking to Alia from within is Agamemnon.
Yeah. No, the family of Atreus, you see.
The family goes back a very long way.
Yes.
It would bring about also an interesting question that since they span so many centuries from the Orestes time through the time when Arrakis became a power, an economic power to deal with, where would the Atreus family be now?
You mean if they existed as a coherent unit?
Yes.
Where would they be?
Mm-hmm.
You mean in our society right now, today, or...
Well, in the 20th century, in the overall society, not 1970 necessarily, but...
Probably running oil tankers or banking in Switzerland.
Yeah, banking in Switzerland seems to fit.
Yeah. You see, how the power hierarchies are set up is... Well, it happens the same way over and over and over and over again. I don't doubt at all, for example, that the Soviet Union, when it began, when the revolution started, that the people were idealists, for the most part. There mm-hmm. were a few coldly cynical types there, I'm sure of that too. But I'm equally sure that most of the people who lent their muscle and their psyches to it were idealists who wanted to improve the lot of mankind. All right, look what's happened. They have created the most overweening, boulder-like, rock-like bureaucracy that the world has ever seen. And the creation of that kind of a bureaucracy, where it cannot be changed easily, is going to destroy them. Obviously, it's going to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been trying to copy their bureaucracy in our society. I think we have caught the ball ahead of it tumbling down and creating an avalanche. But I'm not absolutely sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
the Soviet bureaucracy is a thing to marvel at, because bureaucracies in general tend to project people who are not imaginative, not creative, who are ultra-conservative. You see?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, people who, even if they have imaginative intellectual capabilities, suppress them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's survival. That is protective coloration in the area where they must live.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
If somebody came to you and said, well, Mr. Herbert, you are an extremely sophisticated science fiction writer with a great visionary future. We have this little planet called Mars. We don't know what to do with it, but we got some people there whose ideas have not yet been molded. And we want to just put a society on it that will be self-functioning. What society would you put there?
Well, number one, I'd worry about some of the absolutist assumptions in what society would you put there. I would hope that any society that we build after we find out how we build societies would not be so fixed to any one line that it couldn't change, because it's the ability to change and adapt that gives us our survival. And my dream is that we make the species immortal. Mm-hmm. That's why I like our going to Mars. Why not have that dream? Why not want to have grandchildren to the power of N, you see, infinite numbers of grandchildren off in that future who enjoy life and have all of the beauties of life that we have?
I don't know whether you've covered this, Jim, but it says on the back of the book that you have converted 6 acres or something into an ecological demonstration project. Did you talk about that
yet.
Already? I would really like to know about that.
Well, I'm in the process of working out means, not of isolated survival, but of joining with others.
Have you read Ecotopia by any chance, by Ernst Kallenbach?
I know about the, yes, Ecotopia. I didn't understand you at first. I mm-hmm. thought you said Utopia.
No, Ecotopia.
But Kallenbach got me. Yes, I've read it. I don't believe that any one answer is going to serve us. I'm very much against the use of fission power for electricity, but for none of the reasons that I hear being argued about. It's because I think that we're going to need all of our descendants, and they're going to need all of the real estate they can have, and there is no way that we have found yet to protect ourselves from the kamikaze. And I will give you one little example. Hanford on the Columbia River. A kamikaze attack on Hanford, on their storage right now, would make all of the downstream Columbia River real estate on both sides of the Columbia River uninhabitable. And we're just setting up a lot more of those little enclaves of potentially uninhabitable real estate. And the if you want to see how this is sinking into the psyche of various areas of the world, Great Britain, an island nation, and Japan, an island nation, have both drawn back very sharply from fission power. They know that if they go, if they don't go to a breeder reactor system, that they're going to run out of fuel by the year 2000, and the payoff doesn't seem good enough to them, and I agree with them. I've had some people from Hanford argue with me that, well, France isn't drawing back. But then my answer to that is, well, the people who brought us the Maginot Line and the Concord can't be all wrong.
I gather you would look toward some kind of decentralized
Yes, I believe in... well, we have the capability right now of quadrupling at least our electrical power generation through the use of wind power. And I've demonstrated that to myself for perfect satisfaction. I have built a machine that will do it. Doesn't look like any windmill you ever saw, but it works magnificently. I don't believe that methane is an answer for rolling stock, that is, for running railroads and cars, but it's certainly a marvelous source of energy if you're going to run a stationary internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
So is alcohol. So is hydrogen. All of these things we can get from waste products. The whole concept in the American psyche of things you can throw away and forget about has to be stopped right now. There's no more a way where we can throw things, for one thing, and we need the energy that's potential in these things.
Because getting back to Dune and other books, I think one of the reasons, in my own view, that it was so popular with a lot of people who don't ordinarily enter the kind of science fiction reading situation was because of the ecological framework.
I'm sure that had something to do with it. I hope, though, that it's not taken up by people who are looking for someone who's guilty. We're going to make our own mistakes in our society. If I'd been born in my grandfather's time, I would have made my grandfather's mistakes. We have a terrible propensity in our society for finding guilty people and pointing fingers at them. And oftentimes these guilty people whom we accuse are in positions where they can make decisions of enormous consequences. And all we do by pointing fingers at them is alienate them.
I probably would have to agree with a small portion of that. However, I'm not so sure that power doesn't come into it at some level.
If you want to change the society and not just go on a big revolution trip, if you really want to change the society nonviolently, then we all have to participate in the change. And we have to set it up so that nobody is excluded from participation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand the reason some people can be excluded, and one of them is that we alienate them. Another one is that we have to understand the capitalization process on which our society operates. The capitalization process, which really is the best process we've ever found in the world for making more jobs. In other words, for making things where people will feel that they are justified in their own existence. We've come into some dead ends on it. I agree. We've made mistakes.
Yeah, that's my one fear about Carter, that he'll get us into another war. He'll make some new jobs and get us into another war.
What do you mean, military jobs?
All kinds of jobs, and that he'll find that that's...
Well, I don't think that that's his bag.
I don't either, but systems sometimes are more powerful.
Oh, I agree that systems can direct the decisions you make.
What technological things might possibly create this leverage in job situation as it currently stands?
Well, if we develop fusion power, for example.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was talking about fission, not fusion.
Right.
If we develop fusion power, and we're not at all sure yet that we can, that we have the plasma working techniques that, which will do this. But if we can do it, that's going to change the whole energy picture dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember that what we're dealing with now is a society where crunch decisions are made by people who control enormous blocks of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And who believe that what is good for them will be good for the society. And that's not necessarily true. The oil cartel is not necessarily making decisions which will help the world at large.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. You are listening to an interview I conducted with Frank Herbert during his book tour for the launch of Children of Dune, and we were joined by Margot Adler, who created this show, Hour of the Wolf. I dare say that even with all the hullabaloo of the release of the third screen version of this novel, you have not encountered an interview with the author of this depth and breadth. Frank was live in the Today Show that same morning and was granted a bit under 5 minutes of broadcast time. The difference is that here at WBAI, we tend not to go in for just sound bites on either our live radio or arts or news programs, and I dare say by the time you've heard this whole thing, which continues in a moment, you may attain an understanding of just who Frank Herbert was, how his writing evolved, and I promise Margot makes sure we get into the religious and political aspects of the novel. And that's possible because we are listener-sponsored radio, and we respect our sponsors. That's you. If it's not you, become one. Make a phone call, 212-209-2950, or go on the website, give to WBAI.org. That's the number 2. Give to WBAI.org and make a recurring monthly donation and become a WBAI buddy, or just make an outright donation. Last week, we heard a tad more than half of my interview, which was part of his book tour for Children of Dune, the final book in the series. Or so it was believed. Never mind that Frank wrote at least 3 more, and his son Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson have written at least another 7 or 8 in the series, and I'm sure there are more forthcoming. There's little question that politics notwithstanding, Dune is a masterpiece of science fiction. I would say Dune Messiah swung the opposite direction in quality, but Children of Dune was quite good and maybe should have ended the series there. But the market wants more. So this interview was conducted before the ink had dried on any contract for the movie. Happily, Margot, who was no longer at WBAI full-time, was able to come by in the latter part and join me, and it makes all the difference in the interview. When the novel of Dune came out, it made up one of 3 works that changed Big Publishing's view of speculative fiction. The other 2 books were Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which our previous drama and literature director, Baird Searles, had done quite a bit of work with on the air. All 3 were favorites of the left-leaning mid-60s college crowd, but Herbert wasn't necessarily that far left himself. The novel contains easily recognizable homophobia and a worldview of American and Arab relations that made a major element clear. A white man, a messianic white man, becomes the savior for third world people who just happen to control the most valuable substance the first world wants. Herbert talks about those politics. He was complicated. He was anti-Vietnam, but pro-Nixon. Margot really delves into this. So let's get back into the Wayback Machine for some 54 years ago and listen to part 2 of that discussion. But don't forget, 212-209-2950.
Now, in the area, the interstellar area in which Dune takes place, you have an essentially capitalistic economic background. People are shipping spices, smuggling, very analogous to what we commercially have here. What would be a good working political frame to go with that capitalistic process?
Well, we have developed all kinds of political frameworks to use in our world. But the thing that you have to understand about the capitalistic process is that it adapts to change, mm-hmm. it makes jobs, and it is susceptible, if you don't overmanage it, it is susceptible to variations which are required by the society around it. Where we fall into traps is in overmanagement, over-legalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we do this out of urgent necessity, urgent immediate necessity. But then we never re-examine the conditions, we seldom re-examine the conditions, under which we made those management decisions, you see.
Do you think that we might be better off with an imperialistic capitalism?
An imperial capitalism?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, of course, what I was saying we had.
I'm sorry, what I'm...
you mean, do I think we as a society would be?
Yes.
Not necessarily, no. I'm just saying that that's one of the patterns we tend to fall into. We tend to fall into fiefdoms. After all, what's a corporation?
Mm-hmm.
What's a multinational corporation? There are 14, no, there are more than 20 multinational corporations in this world. And I'm not talking about American corporations. I'm talking about multinational corporations, which have budgets larger than France. Now, some of the smallest decisions that are made by executives in those corporations are going to have far-reaching consequences all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a certain point at which it's possible that the country's borders may just break down and that those multinational corporations will simply become the powers?
I have written such scenarios.
Can I ask which?
No stories. I've done it for corporate management executives.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. What is their basic reaction? Would it be, I assume...
Well, they're
shocked
at first, and then they start exploring the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Where would those possibilities lead in terms of where people live? It would seem to me that you
Well, if we get into too heavy a crisis situation in our world, where survival depends on corporate favor, corporate goodwill,
mm-hmm.
We could find people living in corporate enclaves where the corporation protected them, fed them, gave them medical treatment, cradled to the grave by the corporation, you
mm-hmm.
see. But then you're just going to be building a new cyclic collision society where other corporations will fight. There would be battles between the corporations. I can see another scenario where corporations may prevent war because it's bad for business.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that people have not yet learned.
Yeah.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left to go. To continue with that, could people living under different corporations live together in the same geological area?
Why would they have to?
Well, they might.
Right now, you see, you'll find people who were born as American citizens, people who were born as citizens of France, people who were born as citizens of Great Britain, people who were born as citizens of Tunis, whose first loyalty is to a multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm.
We've found this in testimony in court cases in the United States by American citizens who admit openly that their first loyalty is to the corporation, not to the nation, but to the corporation.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of if you have, say, a non-sectionalized setup. In other words, you might have this...
What do you mean by sectionalized? You mean localized by area and language?
Yes. In other words, what you might end up having with is, would this be conceivable that in New York you're going to have people from 12 different corporations as such living together within the same city, but each pledging allegiance elsewhere? Might that
Don't
not
we
be,
already have that?
Yes, but might that not be, in fact, a deterrent to this war on the grounds of, well, you can't just bomb the city, you're going to...
Well, of course, I suggested one time, quite seriously, that one way, if we really wanted to prevent war, one way to do it would be to negotiate massive exchanges of population for periods of up to 10 or 15 years. Between the Soviet Union and the United States, between the People's Republic of China and the United States, and the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, where you just shift whole cities. And mm-hmm. you go to live in the Soviet Union, learn the language, learn the culture, live by their rules for, say, 10 years. You are, in effect, hostage to the good behavior of your people, of your American citizens. It would be, it's the way we used to do it. Kings used to have princes from neighboring nations living in their own household as hostages to the behavior of the nations on their borders.
Mm. That would really be a fascinating concept. Do you see that since you said these things do work cyclic, that could very well happen?
I could see this happening. I could see be a marvelous adventure for a whole city to say that they will trade with Murmansk and become, say, some city in the United States would become the city of Murmansk for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a massive dislocation and re-education process, you see. But I think it would have salutary effect on the world as a whole. I don't believe, however, in world government.
Mm-hmm.
I think that world government's a very bad show. I think our strength is in our differences, not in the way we are identical. And world government would tend, under present conditions, I'm sure, to be disastrous. It's like the example I like to use is the example of driving an automobile, where there is a 5-minute delay between turning the steering wheel and the front wheels turning. How soon are you going to be in the ditch? The feedback between what is happening to the society and what we now call government is so slow that it's analogous to that picture of a steering wheel with a 5-minute delay.
Mm-hmm. Do you see people trying to steer us toward that world government now?
Oh, I see lots of movements toward world government around us, but I think that they are misguided idealists. Their intentions are right, but we know what the road to hell is paved with, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, I don't think that there are ever any too many political movements that have been paved with bad intentions.
No, I agree.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the saddest things about it, that... It was to somebody, was always a good idea. There are no evil people.
I'm doing this to you for your own good. I'm sorry this rack is stretching your bones.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. But if I don't stretch your bones, you know...
You're going to hell.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The Spanish Inquisition all over. In the time remaining... What are there any things that you would simply like to take to task?
Oh, I think we've touched most of them already. I believe that the major argument I would make is against this kind of absolutist dominance of decision-making in our society. That this society, for example, created Richard Nixon. I am profoundly sympathetic to him, because I'm quite sure that he never woke up any day in his life and said, "Today I'm going to do an evil thing."
Mm-hmm.
He was operating by the rules to which he was conditioned. The society created him. But then the society, needing a scapegoat, turned on him rather than looking to its own shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to do that time and again, not looking at the society's shortcomings, but picking ourselves a goat. And we chase the goat out into the outer darkness and say, "Ah, that's cured it."
How does one change that society? How does one say, all of a sudden, through some miraculous vision in the sky that says, "Look inward"? They look inward and see that it must, something has to be changed.
Well, we have to allow our politicians to make a few mistakes. They're mm-hmm. going to make them anyway, but under present conditions, if they make mistakes, they're going to cover them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't allow them to make mistakes. I think one of the most engaging things that Jimmy Carter, he endeared himself to me by saying, "I blew it," when he was talking about ethnic communities. He said, "I made a mistake." Well, that takes a lot of guts in this society if you want a political career, to stand up and say, "I made a mistake." And maybe we're headed toward a new maturity in that we allowed it.
Mm. Okay, well, all I will say then is thank you very, very much. And it was a pleasure.
My pleasure. I hope to see you again.
Okay.
You have been listening to an interview with the author of Dune, Frank Herbert, conducted by Margot Adler and myself, Jim Freund, in 1976. If you want to hear more of Dan, and for that matter, my assessment of Dune Part 1, join Dan and I, and with any luck another critic and pundit, this Sunday, October 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, for a live video chat simulcast on YouTube and Facebook. For YouTube, just youtube.com/c/Jim Freund, that's F-R-E-U-N-D, or go to Facebook to the Hour of the Wolf group. And most importantly, Don't forget to support WBAI by making a pledge at 212-209-2950 or visiting us at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Join us next week, Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for our Samhain, or if you prefer, Halloween program, featuring Shirley Jackson herself reading what may be the best horror short story of all time, The Lottery. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. If you enjoyed the program you just listened to, think about becoming a WBAI buddy. Sign up, have a certain amount taken out of your account on a monthly basis, $5, $10, $15, $20, $25. Whatever you can do, that will be a cushion that BAI can rely on a monthly basis and plan accordingly. You go to give to the number 2 WBAI.org and become a WBAI buddy. So do it now. Go to give to the number 2 WBAI.org. But whatever you do, do something. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock.
Tell me
Please.
A story about Thank your time you. At WBAI so I can let people know that you, in fact, have returned from retirement.
I retired because I was tired, but I found retirement more tiring than coming to BAI. BAI can be exhausting. Trump's there, and you have to yak about it. And if you're sitting at home, you're just shouting to the walls. When you have a program at WBAI, you can alert them about Donald Trump.
That's David Rothenberg. Tune in to Any Saturday, Saturday mornings from 8 to 10.
This is a well-oiled promotion, please.
I believe. that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan. On WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
Hard work is how we support ourselves and our families. The jobs we do are a big part of who we are. And our jobs keep America going. Yet, the job site is where we have the least power. Many of us voiceless as corporations gamble away our health and our family's future just to feed their greed. It's time for the working class majority, for you and me, to regain our voices, to turn up the volume, assert our collective power, and to organize. Join me, Rick Smith, every Saturday night from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York as we bring the class war and fight for a better future. The Rick Smith Show, every Saturday night, 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York's listener-supported radio. For more information, visit WBAI.org.
Testing 1-2. Comrade, is this thing on? Is it working?
It's working good.
Saturday, October 23rd from 8 to 10 p.m. on WBAI Playhouse, a Huey P. Newton story by Roger Guinevere Smith.
The day I came out of prison was a hot, sunny day. The sun was shining, so, you know, I took my shirt off, and a lot of people wanted to read like a grand gesture. I'm part into that. Like it was
compiled from the writings and speeches of the co-founder of the Black Panthers.
And a letter from the Hollywood studio says something to the effect of, "Dear Mr. Newton, we feel that you have star quality."
That's a Huey P. Newton story. Theater for the ear.
These Hollywood studios are a trip, aren't they? Because they're in the business of creating fiction. But we in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense are in the business of creating non-fiction. You know what I'm saying? Non-fiction. We're making revolution.
Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. on WBAI New York.
Coming soon to a cinema near you. Here's a selection from the soundtrack. Hope you enjoy it. Available now on Panther Records and Tapes. In 8 tracks.
In communities all over the country, there are battles going on. Sometimes this battle is a war of words, but lately it's becoming more and more violent. At the center of the conflict is critical race theory. Join me, Bernard White of UPAMA, and Jamel K. Doner, Associate Professor of Education at William & Mary, Tanya K. Hernandez, Professor of Law at Fordham University, and David E. Kirkland, Professor of Urban Education at New York University, as they answer your questions and present the reality of critical race theory. Become a part of this online discussion Saturday, October 23rd from 2 to 4 p.m. For free registration, contact upamainc.org/events. That's upamainc.org/events as we present Critical Race Theory, the Facts and the Fiction.
On October 24th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Richard Tucker Park on 66th Street and Broadway, Crossways Theater presents a stop anti-Asian hate play titled COVID Crime. Speakers Shirley Eng from Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund and Jackie Wang from Welcome to Chinatown. Free. Peace cranes will be distributed.
We will not bow down to our racism.
From October 22nd to 25th, the International Tribunal on U.S. Human Rights Abuses
against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples with an esteemed global panel of jurists will convene in person and via live stream. Tune into WBAI's special coverage of testimony about the unjust incarceration and poor medical care of U.S. political prisoners, hosted by Basir M. Chawi and Bob Lederer. That's Saturday, October 23rd from 4 to 6 p.m. here on WBAI. Again, this is Saturday, 4 to 6 p.m. And you can hear the live stream of the entire tribunal from Friday evening, October 22nd to Monday afternoon, October 25th by going to tribunal2021.com. Again, tribunal2021.com.
We're in a unique moment here. It's a moment where we have a chance to actually demonstrate our power.
Imhotep Gary Bird, heard on WBAI Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m.
I learned from Dr. Walter Fauntroy, who fought with Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, that there were five areas that they identified that they felt politics could control and hit. It was health, housing, education, economics, and social justice. The fact is, WBAI is a nexus for the progressive community to make those changes in all of those areas and has been decade after decade. I say to you again, whose station?
Our station!
Whose control?
Our control!
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally-controlled WBAI New York.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song. Or sing it, Jimmy Boy. Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you gotta start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Well, if that's Jimmy Durante, then I must be David Rothenberg, and it's a little after 8. We call this program Any Saturday. I have no idea why. It's on WBAI, listener-sponsored, 99.5 FM in the city of New York. I took my morning walk this morning, talk about redundancy, and it was dark out. It's changing. Reminded, you know, I was walking offended that the earth has done that to me, that when I take the walk on a Saturday morning that it's dark at 6:30. And I remembered for some reason, as I was cursing the darkness, that when I was in high school, a friend of my mother's called. She couldn't find a babysitter and so wasn't going to do whatever she was going to do with my mother. And I said, oh, I'll sit for Hal. He was 4 years old, and I always liked, he was an adorable little boy, and I always enjoyed when he came and visited. So I went over and babysat, and we played a little bit. And when I said, all right, Hal, it's now time to go to bed. And I said, I'm going to turn out the light. And he said, okay, David, but don't put on the dark. I was so taken by that. The Daily News used to have something called Bright Sayings, and you got $2 for it. And I sent it in, and they printed it. And to this day, I don't think I ever got the $2 from the Daily News. Hal went on to be a best-selling author. He wrote a book about his son. But I thought that was wonderful. I'm putting on, turning out the light. Yeah, David, but don't put on the dark. 4 years old. Wonderful. Well, last night was full of basketball for me. The Knicks won 2 in a row, looking sharp. The Nets not looking so sharp, but in the fourth quarter, they gained their, they found themselves and they defeated Philadelphia. So they're 1-1. The Knicks in first place in the East made me excited. And then late at night, trying to stay awake, I watched, the Lakers and Phoenix, and the Lakers with LeBron James and Anthony Davis and Russell Westbrook lost their second game, 2 out of 2. But the highlight of that game, which you will see if you put on ESPN, because they will probably replay it 103 times and analyze it, as two of the Laker players had a fight on the bench during the game, Anthony Davis and Dwight Howard. Now talk about indicating that there's some problem in the locker room. They didn't wait till they got into the locker room. And Dwight Howard's an interesting case. When he came to Orlando, maybe a dozen years ago, 7 foot tall, handsome kid from the country. And at interviews, he was humble and excited about playing. And he was a wonderful athlete. And I watched the evolution of him. And it's not been pleasant. He's been traded about 5 or 6 times, which must mean that he's not good in the locker room or good for the chemistry of a team, because in the evolution, I've watched him become a nasty fouler, a complainer. And I remember that that kind of sweet young man that was playing and was a great athlete at 20 in Orlando, and at 32 or 33 with millions and millions of dollars, he's become an unpleasant human being. I don't know the cause of the fight on the bench, but can you imagine in the middle of a game when you're losing to Phoenix that two players having a fight? Put on ESPN. I'm sure that they'll interrupt 43 games today to show you that fight. So, you know what? I'm not even going to wait. We have theater tickets, and the people that tune in early should have a head start. Why not? He says as he coughs. The morning, P-H-E-L, how do you spell phlegm? Charming. Isn't that what you want to hear in the morning from someone, that they have phlegm? Mornings at 7. We had tickets all this week. Well, the first person that called me, and she knows who she is, fetched and complained. The next 6 emails I got were nothing but how much they enjoyed the acting, the play, the everything about the production. One man wrote, this is what theater should be. I got 2 phone calls thanking me. I didn't write it and I didn't produce it. I just made it available to listeners It's called Mornings at 7. I saw it 40 years ago, which was a revival then, and won a Tony Award for the best revival. It's by Paul Osborne. They have a wonderful cast now at St. Clement's. Judith Lowry, Patty McCormick, who was our guest last week. She of, when she was a little girl, of the Bad Seed fame, now a grandmother. Lindsay Krause, John Rubenstein, Dan Loria, Tony Roberts. Good cast. I'm going next week. And you can go next week, too. No, I'm going the week after, I think. They have critics' performances. And since I review, I can't go until they tell me. But you can go this week, Monday night at 7, Wednesday matinee, Wednesday night at 7, Thursday and Friday at 7, Saturday matinee and Sunday matinee. Now, I have at Saturday night at 8. I have to warn, no, the Sunday matinee's gone. I have to warn you. And we, a station that attracts people of a certain age, the matinees go quickly and there's not many left. So hopefully some of you will consider going out at night. These are 7 o'clock curtains on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturdays at 8 o'clock. But you're grown up. You can go out at night. Are you ready for all that? I mean, the world is, we're coming back, are we not? So if you want to see Mornings at 7, it's $50 goes to WBAI and you get two tickets. And that is what is known in Paris as a mitzvah, a gift, if you will. So what you do is email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Then you give your phone number and I will spend the rest of my Saturday calling you and the others, as I seem to be. How'd you spend your Saturday, David? Calling BAI people. And you're a chatty group. I must say I enjoy it, though. I enjoy talking with the listeners. The only thing that bothers me is, what was that song you played last October? And startling, I don't remember it. But Mornings at 7 sounds like theater that we want to get back to. It takes place at a simpler time, in a simpler place, with wonderful actors. So on your mark, get set, go. Early bird gets the worm and the tickets to the theater. And we play some music for you. Now, these two ladies, each of them had a career of some substance. And together, with this Harold Arlen and Ted Koehler song, they may start your Saturday off. One's name is Barbara Streisand. Her singing partner, Judy Garland.
Forget your trouble.
Happy days.
Come on, get happy.
Here again, a sky
on a cares
above a clear again.
Shout hallelujah.
So let's sing a song.
Come on, get happy.
Cheer again.
Get ready.
Happy
for
days
the
are here again.
The sun is shining.
Shout it now,
love
there's no one
to take your
who
hand.
Can tout it now.
Shout hallelujah.
So let's tell the world
and just get happy
about it now.
We're
happy days are here again. We're heading across a river. Soon your cares will all be gone.